I call the meeting of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. A quorum is present. Before we start, I want to just take a moment and thank Bennett Smith for his years of work. This is his last day at the Minnesota. This is the last day of the Minnesota of Bennett's work at the Minnesota House. So we want to thank Bennett Smith for his work and wish him well in the future. Representative Lee, would you like to move the minutes for January 18th?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the minutes for January 18th.
Representative Lee moves the minutes for January 18th. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Ayes have it, the motion prevails. The minutes are approved. The first bill on the calendar is House File 234 by Representative Vang. This bill was heard last week. We are not taking any testimony on it. We do have an amendment, and so Representative Vang, would you move House File 234 for be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move that House File 234 be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means.
And Representative Vang, I believe you have an A1 author's amendment. Would you like to move your amendment and describe it briefly?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will move the A1 amendment. The A1 amendment addresses some of the questions member asked in the last committee hearing. The most important changes are in subdivision 2 license exemptions. One is it adds an exemption to allow restaurants and retail outlets to buy turtles for resale at a licensed aquatic farm or a licensed private fish hatchery, and also clarifies that kids under 16 years old can take turtles up to 3 for personal use. And then another important change would be adding Section 8, which adds effective date to January 1st, 2024. And with that, that is the A1 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Are there any questions to the A1 amendment? Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Ayes have it. The amendment is adopted. Representative Vang, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think today is a good day for turtles. We've been talking a lot about this for a couple of years, and we had a good hearing, so I appreciate members of the committee's support. And with that, I move that the motion, House File 234, as amended, be recommended to be re-referred to Ways and Means.
Members, any final questions? Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. Ayes have it. House File 234 as amended has been approved and recommended to go to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you, Representative Vang. Next up will be House File 389. And that is mine. Representative, could you take this, please?
Next up, we have House File 389 from Chair Hansen. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House File 389 be recommended to be referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Great. We have a number of testifiers today, but would you like to start with testimony, or would you like to explain your bill?
Just it's a relatively simple bill. Members, this is part of our catch-up and cleanup from previous years that we've been talking about. The lottery in lieu tax was allocated in the late 90s and early 2000s. Originally, at 97% of that tax went 50% to the Heritage Enhancement Account, 22.5% to State Parks and Trails, 22.5% to Metropolitan Parks and Trails, 3% for local trail grants, and 2% for zoos. During the budget crisis of the early 2000s, that was reduced to 72.43%. What this bill does is restores it back to the 97 and a little further to 99%. You have in your file the fiscal note that shows how much money would be raised It would cost the general fund $11.990 million in 2024, and that would be allocated to the percentages that I just described. So we're not changing the allocation of where it goes. We're changing the amount that is sent to those allocations. And those allocations have to be made by the legislature. So it's not a grant process. We would have to appropriate those each biennium on where they go. So that is the bill, and there are many testifiers and letters, so we might as well start with those, Madam Chair.
Great. Thank you, Representative Hansen. First on my list is Brian Rice from the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brian Rice.
State your name.
My name is Brian Rice. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis, and I'm here today representing the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board. And I might say thank you very much to the legislature. In 1883, 140 years ago, this legislature created the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board to create parks in and adjacent to the city of Minneapolis, and we've greatly benefited by everything this legislature has done, including this bill. As you notice, the bill is actually pretty simple. If you just look on page 3, line 1, there's just one change in it, and it's simply a formula change. And as Representative Hansen explained, I'll just give a quick history back on this. In 1988, when the legislature authorized the lottery amendment, they said it was going to be dedicated to funding environmental needs. And as part of the legislation that passed that put that measure on the ballot, the legislature created Chapter 116P, which established the Environmental Natural Resource Trust Fund, to say how those dollars would be used. As part of the enactment of the lottery, on every time you buy a lottery ticket, there's a tax in lieu of a sales tax that gets paid to the gets paid to the state. And from that allocation in this chapter, 297A, a percentage of that tax is dedicated to these environmental purposes. One is the Heritage Enhancement Account in the Game and Fish Fund. That's 50% of the money. If you look on page 3.4 of the sales tax proceeds goes to the Heritage Enhancement Account in the Game and Fish Fund that can only be spent to improve, enhance, protect fish and wildlife resources, conservation, restoration, enhancement land. 3.8 is 22.5 goes to the Natural Resources Fund and may be only spent on state parks and trails. 3.10 is 22.5% are deposited in the Natural Resource Fund and spent on metropolitan grants and trails. Then 3% is spent for local trail grants, and 2% are spent on the three zoos in the state. This amendment may sound familiar because it's really the precursor of the legacy amendment that Senator Lessard worked on. Starting after 1998 when they passed the constitutional amendment to hunt and fish. That effort was a 10-year effort, and early in the session of the legislature in 2020 or 2000 didn't put on the ballot, but they did carve out this pot of money to help those natural resource things. 8 years later, it did get the legacy amendment got put on the ballot and much expanded to not only Lessard Sams, but water, clean water, arts and culture. The point of all this is, and I think the chair knows and the committee members know, it's very difficult to get resources for natural resource funding. I don't know what the governor did in his budget this time, but natural resource funding is almost always an afterthought. I think our key strategy that's been employed by this legislature and advocates of the environment are to look for dedicated funds like this so that the legislature, when you ultimately make your spending decisions, there's some resources that you have to allocate to the various needs that happen in state parks and trail, the enhancement account, metro parks, all these other things. And as Representative Hansen said, we were successful in 2000, but in a very short period of time because, you know, there was the budget crisis in the early 2000. Governor Pawlenty was there. It was a $4.5 billion deficit. He said he was going to solve the budget and not through tax increases. So what did he do? Everybody had to shrink down. The legislature clawed back a lot of this money from the fund, and it's never been replaced. And you're at this new epoch or new period where you have a chance to at least say these lottery tickets were originally sold. I remember the ads, you know, the loon was looning and, you know, parks and trails and the environmental benefit from it. Well, here's a way to restore that pledge and say that if you get these resources that are captured, that will go to these legislatively defined things. And I might say a key part of that, I worked on the 1986 legislation on the lottery. One of your predecessors, Representative Jordan, Representative Kahn, specifically defined natural resources to include Chapter 86A in the DNR statute that said those are part of their outdoor recreation systems, and Chapter 473, which defines the regional park system, to say that these are natural resources of the state and they should be funded through these means. So I would really encourage the committee, if you do this, it's basically going to ensure that these resources flow to your committee. And as Representative Hansen said, this isn't appropriating money directly. It's giving the money in an account to this committee to then decide where do they go within these categories. And it's just vitally important to the systems. I've been fortunate enough to represent the Park Board for 40 years, and I can tell you this source of funding and is so transformative that you can actually sit down and plan then and say the resources will be there for our parks, our trails in the metro area, in the state, in the Heritage Enhancement Account, where you have so many needs. And I know there's just a big demand. And so, Mr. Chair, thank you very much for bringing this forward again. Many efforts, and hopefully this is the year. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. You can stick around. We'll do questions after all the testimony. Next on my list is Mark McCabe from Ramsey County. Welcome to the committee, Mr. McCabe. When you have situated yourself, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Mark McCabe, and I'm the director of Ramsey County Parks and Recreation, but I'm here today representing the 10 agencies that make up the Metropolitan Regional Park System. So I'm here to speak in support of this bill on behalf of all those agencies. As Mr. Rice said, he pointed out a number of things that I'm in agreement with, and I just want to, there was a handout in your packet. Don't think you have the color version, but black and white version that talks about the operation and maintenance funding that the agencies receive from the state, and just has a number of statistics on it that talks about the metropolitan park system. So includes some statistics about the number of acres. We're talking with the collective system over 54,000 acres of public parkland, over 415 miles of connected trails, so bikeways, walkways, things like that, 56 regional parks. And in 2021, we had over 65 million visits in 2021. So we go out and do park counts. So that is a substantial number of people utilizing the system and creating wear and tear in the system that this operation and maintenance funding is so critical to support. We saw through the COVID era and continue to how many people were out and about utilizing the park system, how much they appreciated that access, and what that did for their mental and physical well-being. So just really appreciative of what we received to help maintain that system for the public. In going through this document, we do outline that Minnesota State Statute 473.351 authorizes no less than 40% of the actual cost to be appropriated from state funding for the operation and maintenance of the Metropolitan Regional Park System. Total agency operations and maintenance expenditures currently exceed $120 million. So 40% of that amount would be roughly $48 million. The regional park system currently receives approximately $10 million, which is around 9% of the operations and maintenance. So from the 40% in the state statute, we're receiving about 9% of the funding necessary for operation of the maintenance costs. The regional park implementing agencies have to pick up a big portion of the state's share, and when the agencies aren't able to do that, they're not able to adequately maintain the parks and trails, quality of the system goes down, as does our visitor satisfaction. So passing this bill will provide approximately $2.6 million additional dollars to the regional park system for operation and maintenance funding, which makes some progress toward that goal and just helps ensure that we can adequately maintain the system. So we really appreciate your consideration of support of this bill to help maintain the system for all users to enjoy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCabe. Next on my list is Brad Gausman from the Minnesota Conservation Federation. Mr. Gausman, please come down, introduce yourself, correct my pronunciation of your name if you're here. There you are. And proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon. Excuse me. My name is Brad Gausman. I'm executive director of the Minnesota Conservation Federation. Thank you to the chair and members of the committee for having me today. The Minnesota Conservation is a coalition of individuals, groups, and communities dedicated to outdoor recreation and the conservation and ethical use of Minnesota's natural resources by all, for all, with all. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today in support of HF 389. Minnesota is fortunate to have outdoor recreational opportunities available for its citizens and visitors. Members of the Minnesota Conservation Federation can be found angling, paddling, hunting, foraging, and simply enjoying time outdoors throughout our states in its many seasons. The access to and quality of the experiences to be had in Minnesota's outdoors is not a coincidence. It is the result of generations of planning and stewardship that includes the development of dedicated sources for conservation funding. The lottery and loose sales tax passed by the Minnesota legislature in 2000 represents one of the mechanisms developed to fund conservation in Minnesota. This in lieu of sales tax collected from the sale of lottery tickets was intended to establish the Heritage Enhancement Account, among others, within the Minnesota DNR Game and Fish Fund. If you hunt, fish, access streams for paddling, or desire to see our state's game and fish laws enforced, then the funding of the Minnesota DNR Game and Fish Fund is important to you. The time is now to restore the lottery and loot funds to conservation as they were originally intended, so that future generations of outdoor enthusiasts can enjoy the same opportunities to access quality outdoor experiences as we do today. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on my list is Ms. Renee Mattson from the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission. Thank you for being here, Ms. Mattson. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Renee Mattson, Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission Executive Director. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. I want to thank you for allowing me to share our concerns and the concerns of our sister organization, Greater Minnesota Parks and Trails. Yes, we sound a lot alike. About the lack of funding for Greater Minnesota in House File 389 and our hope that you can remedy this historical inequity. Regional parks and trails differ from state parks, but they play an essential role in the bridge between the local park and the around the corner in Minnesota's outstanding state parks. They're a close to home option for both the community and visitors around them. Regional parks and trails have long existed in Greater Minnesota and in the metropolitan area. Yet metropolitan parks are the only ones that receive funding from lottery and lieu. We believe this is a historical oversight when the legislation that dedicated 22.5% of the available lottery and lieu funds to metropolitan parks, there was no formal organizing agency for Greater Minnesota to make the case for those funds. Times have changed, and the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission was formed in 2013 to develop a system of regionally designated facilities in the 80 counties not served by the Metropolitan Council. Since then, more than 74 parks, trails, and special features across the state, such as the Mesabi Trail, the Greater Mankato River Valley Trail System, and the Winona Bluffs Traverse have all been added to this system. Despite the wide reach of this regional park system, we are now significantly underfunded, as you can see when you look at how lottery and lieu funds are divided up. Metropolitan Parks and Trails receive 22.5%, while Greater Minnesota receives none. The bill before you increases the amount of lottery and lieu funding by about 25%, and we believe that a portion of that increase, even just 5%, should be dedicated to Greater Minnesota to continue to create, rehabilitate, and repair and build connections to the outdoors for all Minnesotans as well as visitors to Minnesota. Quick math indicates that 5% would translate to approximately $4.6 million per biennium. And for Greater Minnesota, that figure would represent funding for many additional projects, creating more and better opportunities for outdoor recreation, as well as many more ways in which to connect people with the outdoors, to continue to build upon the strong outdoor tradition that makes Minnesota such a special place to live and work. Minnesotans value their close proximity to nature, and by providing this funding, you would be strongly supporting the facilities, trails, and special features that are so important to all of us. We ask you to please consider our request, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on my list is Sarah Cicchetto from the Mesabi Trail. Please introduce yourself to the committee and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Sarah Cicchetto, and I am the Deputy Director of the St. Louis and Lake County's Regional Railroad Authority. I'm here today in support of House File 389, Lottery in Lieu. Besides owning and maintaining the Lakefront Line Railroad that runs from Duluth to Two Harbors, this rail authority has also proudly built and now maintains the Mesabi Trail, a paved bike trail that extends from the Mississippi River in Grand Rapids to the gateway of the Boundary Waters in Ely. The state of Minnesota and the Legislative Citizens Commission on Minnesota Resources have been important partners in building this unique and scenic paved trail that currently winds through 28 communities and two counties. To date, 156 miles of this trail are paved and finished. By the end of 2024, we expect that the main planned route of the Mesabi Trail will be fully complete, covering a total distance of 162 miles, being one of the longest paved bike trails in the state, if not the country. After that, we will move on to developing spur routes to connect additional communities in the area to our trail. While this trail is not a state-designated trail sponsored by the DNR, we have benefited from your support, and we wholeheartedly support Lottery in Lieu and House File 389, a bill that would bring more funding to state DNR parks and trails in the metro area. In our experience, people now, especially post-pandemic, are taking advantage of the opportunities that parks and trails provide to get outdoors. And to that end, the Mesabi Trail has seen a significant increase in users in the past year. As technology advances, the need for access to parks and trails increases. So while we may not be eligible for most of the increased funds, we still support these efforts because parks and trails benefit all Minnesotans, including our trail guests, and promotes healthier lifestyles. The legislature and you, Madam Chair, have been thoughtful in your approach to providing these resources. Minnesotans have a great respect for the outdoors and for recreational opportunities, whether that means boats, snowmobiles, and ATVs, or bikes, hiking, and camping in both the metro area and Greater Minnesota. When opportunity arises, we should all collectively support these good works because our fellow citizens applaud them, use them, and we all benefit from them. On behalf of the Mesabi Trail, we support House File 389. Thank you.
Thank you. And then last on my list, I have Eli Mansfield from Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, and then we will go into member questions. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Mansfield, please proceed. Please introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Eli Mansfield, Board Chairman, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers of Minnesota. Madam Chair, member of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm representing the Minnesota chapter of Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. And Backcountry Hunters and Anglers is a national nonprofit conservation organization focused on public land and public water advocacy and access for all. That's hunting, fishing, hiking, biking, camping, you name it. If you do it outside, we support it. Backcountry Hunters and Anglers nationally has a membership that has eclipsed 30,000. In the state of Minnesota, we have 1,400 members at the time of this testimony. Those are very engaged individuals, and for our group, are representative of the political spectrum across the state. Additionally, those members have an average age of 35 years old. We work not only for the present tasks that face conservation, but we also respect our outdoor heritage and the work that's been done over the years to make sure that we have that funding, as well as looking forward to the future of conservation through pragmatic stewardship of our shared resources. You know, I myself, I'm a transplant here to Minnesota. I moved up here a decade ago from Indiana. I came to study at the University of Minnesota and get my master's degree in public health. Although where I'm from is the epitome of rural America, the five-county area surrounding my hometown was made up of less than 1% public land. When I came to Minnesota, the vast experiences and the opportunities I had to explore the outdoors and be outdoors, and the quality of the habitat and the experiences that I was able to garner when I first moved here over 10 years ago, no doubt the reason that I still remain here in the state and the reason that my family and I have set roots and will build our future here. House File 389, it offers the opportunity to accomplish shared goals, goals of state agencies, goals of nonprofit organizations, goals of conservationists, and of our communities. The balanced approach to funding will really create an opportunistic diaspora of outdoor experiences from our urban and suburban areas throughout the state, not just out into the backwoods of hunting. The proposed distribution of funds will inspire on a local level as it relates to, as we've heard already, zoos, metropolitan parks, and metropolitan trails. And the goal is for that inspiration to then lead those people from their local area out to explore the other advancements and improvements that will be done with this funding. And that's at the state park and state trail level. BHA fully supports the attributed funding to improving, enhancing, and protecting fish and wildlife resources. That is very specifically called out there. And we really like to draw attention to the focus on the funding for field operations, which we just recently heard is extremely important. My first trip into the wild in Minnesota, it wasn't to the towering pines up north, and it wasn't to the Boundary Waters. My first trip over 10 years ago, it was to the Front Range of the Great Plains, which might not sound that exciting to a lot of you, but for, at the time, a kid from Indiana, I got to spend a whole day walking on public land that was accessible, that was maintained, and I got to hunt for pheasants, and so many times I paused in that moment to just take that in and look around, and there was a real serenity in that perceived endlessness that was the western Minnesota prairie. I and Backcountry Hunters and Anglers of Minnesota, we offer our full support for House File 389. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you for your civil service and for the time to speak with you here today. Thank you all very much.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Mansfield. Next, we will go to questions from members. And first on my list is Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question for Chair Hansen. When this was initially established as 97%, and now you're going to 99, I'm just wondering what the logic is of why not revert back to 97 instead of 99, and why not just go to 100?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Burkle, I didn't want to look too greedy and ask for it all. I believe that, when this was first done, we were in a paper world, and administrative costs and having people manage this. Now these transfers are probably with the flick of a computer tablet. So it's just the administrative cost of managing this should be less. Last year we had 97%. I felt that we could go to 99%, but still leave 1% if there are administrative costs that are needed going into the general fund.
Representative Burkle. Nothing further. Further question from members. Any further discussion on the bill? Is there anyone in the audience that would like to testify for or against House File 389? Well, Representative Hansen, any closing comments?
Madam Chair, thank you. I want to address a little bit about the distribution. And so think of this, if I'll use a food analogy, we're increasing the size of the pizza, but we're not changing the toppings. The percentage is still the percentages are still the same. We're adding more to them. But if we look at the beauty of what was established over 20 years ago, that 50% to heritage enhancement, most of that is going to go to Greater Minnesota. Most of that is going to go to the, but we get to decide that. So we get to allocate that, and we can make those decisions with that 50%. The 22.5%, likely that's going to go to Greater Minnesota, but we get to decide that, and we get to make those allocations. The 22.5% for Metropolitan Parks and Trails, again, that's 22.5% of this whole, but we get to decide that. 3% for local trail grants. We heard how just even that 3% has helped out with the Mesabi Trail and other local trail grants, and we get to make that decision here in this committee. And then the percentage for the zoos, the Minnesota Zoo, the Como Zoo, and the Duluth Zoo. Again, some reliable funds that we can make those appropriations. So I'd ask for your support. This restores a wrong that was done over 20 years ago. It's part of the catch-up and cleanup that I hopefully we can find broad bipartisan support on, and I'd ask your support.
With that, Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 389 be recommended to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. And the motion prevails.
Members in the audience, we're going to recess for about 5 minutes while the author is coming from another committee. So we're in recess for 5 minutes.
Very deep in mind.
The committee will reconvene. Members, we have House File 100 in front of us. Representative Stevenson, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 100 to be referred to the Labor and Industry Finance and Policy Committee. Just for the members and for the audience, our portion of this, the environmental portion, and the debate and the testimony is confined to a few articles. Article 1, Section 8, Establishment of Environmental Standards, Sections 21, 22, 23, 33, and Section 44. And I'm sure Representative Stevenson will define those for us. Welcome to the committee. And if you could present those portions of House File 100.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House File 100, as you mentioned, is the bill to legalize adult use cannabis in the state of Minnesota. As I've said in other committees, Minnesotans are ready. This is the year that we should legalize adult use cannabis in the state of Minnesota. Minnesotans deserve the freedom and respect to make their own decisions about cannabis. And we also need to recognize that our current laws are doing more harm than good. With respect to this specific committee, we're here today to discuss the provisions pertaining to the implications for the environment and for environmental protection in connection with this bill. As the chair noted, there's a few provisions that I know were helpfully listed out in the agenda for today. The first is Section 8, which allows for the PCA to establish some environmental standards with regard to the cannabis industry in various sectors, including energy and odor and so on, water significantly. There's also specific provisions relating to several of the different licensing provisions in the bill. So as we create a safe and legal marketplace for cannabis, it involves a licensed industry with several licensed components of that industry, ranging from cannabis cultivators, cannabis cultivator operations, cannabis manufacturer licensing, cannabis microbusiness licensing, and medical cannabis licensing. And in each of those instances, there's a requirement that certain information relating to the environmental footprint of the activity are a component of the application for license. This is a big bill, and there's a lot going on here. The components related to the environment, you know, are an important piece, but a pretty defined piece. So perhaps I will leave it at that, and I'm happy to answer questions or do whatever the chair would like at this point.
Members, we've got a number of testifiers. Why don't we start with the testifiers, and then that may prompt some questions. And then if members do have a question, just let us know. First up, Layli Fatahi, Minnesota is ready. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Layli Fatahi, and I am the campaign manager for MN is Ready, the unified multipartisan campaign to legalize adult use cannabis in Minnesota. We bring together the largest and most diverse coalition of cannabis policy stakeholders in Minnesota, including industry members, aligned advocacy groups, community advocates, and other supporters to ensure that grassroots constituencies are working directly with lawmakers to pass a full adult use cannabis legalization that works for our state. We appreciate the committee's time and consideration today of House File 100's provisions for setting and enforcing water, energy, and waste standards for the cannabis industry, as well as requirements for resource management planning as part of the licensing process. We understand that there are concerns about the environmental sustainability and impacts of both the existing hemp market as well as the expanded cannabis market in our many interactions with cannabis industry members in Minnesota, we've seen a strong overall commitment to sustainability and environmental stewardship. However, given the longstanding federal policy of cannabis prohibition, there is a lack of cannabis-specific standards and guidelines at the federal level to help govern as our state transitions beyond hemp to a full to full THC cannabis cultivation and products. And so we appreciate the legislature's attention to the need for state-level standards and business planning requirements to help ensure that the industry's resource use and management practices remain sustainable and responsible as the market expands to include the broader cannabis market. Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, Tom Cotter, Superior Cannabis Company. Tom Cotter, Superior Cannabis Company. Next up, Nate Atkins, Libertarian Party of Minnesota. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you very much. My name is Nate Atkins. I am the political director of the Libertarian Party of Minnesota. While we don't have a member of our party in the legislature, our elected officials represent over 5 million residents in the state of Minnesota. I appreciate the courtesy of this committee allowing our party to testify on such an important bill. When it comes to licensing and really the impacts that could have and the relationship it has to the environment, I would encourage the members of this committee to consider how licensing can affect economic opportunities of Minnesotans. Licensing requirements, as envisioned by the government, are intended to ensure that consumers are able to trust those they patronize for various goods and services. I think that's commonly accepted by many people as the intention of licensing requirements. But no matter how well-intentioned government policy, one must consider the real-world unintended effects of those policies. I would like to see a market for cannabis in Minnesota where family-owned farms can not only cultivate small amounts of cannabis, but also bring it to sale at their local farmers' markets. Also, consider the number of growing number of community gardens. In said gardens, community members share the responsibility of cultivating various vegetables, fruits, or legumes, and share their bounty with those in their community. We should allow for a regulatory environment where community members could utilize their community gardens for the cultivation of cannabis. Cannabis can and should be sold by the community to help support local programs, mutual aid, or various welfare services. Loosening of the regulatory licensing requirements will increase the economic mobility of those less fortunate and those on the margins of our society. In order for small businesses to thrive, the cap on 5,000 square feet for outdoor growing purposes needs to be increased to a bare minimum of 3 acres. This would allow farmers to plan for and sustain themselves through losses due to theft or environmental forces. While every business owner seeks to grow their business, the licensing provisions in this bill would make growth for the small business owner too onerous. In short, it would be too expensive for a small business to grow if they have to meet the licensing requirements in this bill. As it is currently written, the licensing requirements of the bill only serve to benefit large corporate pharmaceutical operations at the expense of small businesses and the consumer. Furthermore, requiring plants to be grown indoors would knock family farms out of growing. They would need to make heavy capital investments to grow. The stated reasons for indoor grows are primarily environmental. Yet the current hemp farm products are already tested for herbicide and pesticide contaminants. That should be the standard, the lab results, not if the plants were grown inside or outside. In addition to this, indoor growing requires a lot of electricity to power the lights and the irrigation systems. This would add stress to an already leveraged energy system. Another aspect worth considering is the point system. Points are given to minority or women-owned businesses, but not for organic or regenerative farmers. What is desperately needed in the cannabis industry are products grown with organic and regenerative processes. This is both good for the consumer and the environment. Cannabis plants can be used to decontaminate the soil, as was done at the site of a former steel mill in Italy, with the land now being used for agriculture. The flip side to this, unfortunately, is that any materials absorbed by the cannabis plant can be released when smoked by the user. This is one of the many reasons why we need to have a regulatory environment that allows for organic and regenerative practices. I previously mentioned the idea that licensing allows for consumers to trust the producers they are interacting with. Ask any member of a farmer's market what the most significant form of regulatory licensing is, and they will tell you it's trust, plain and simple. A farmer's market operates off of trust, trust between consumers and producers. And in smaller community-centric farmers markets, which many of them are, trust is the currency with which they operate. While I can understand the desire to ensure this trust and safety for your constituents, what I hope is that you will consider trusting the people of Minnesota. I believe that all Minnesotans want what is best for their communities and that they should be trusted. We consider this the official position of the Libertarian Party on Article 1 of HF 100. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Elena Niehoff. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Elena Niehoff. I am a registered nurse from Rochester, Minnesota. I'm testifying in objection of Bill HF 100. I would like to express my deepest concern and sorrow caused by the action of Democrat majority in the House. This bill targets young and immature people and will cause the grief to many parents and the grandparents. Please connect the dots and try to see the bigger picture here. Our country has opened borders in the South. It is estimated that 2 million people migrated unlawfully through the southern borders within the last 2 years. Nobody checked their background. Have those people committed a crime?
Yeah.
Yes.
You're supposed to confine your testimony to Article 1, Section 8, the environmental portions.
Thank you, sir.
Border crossing has nothing to do with Article 1, Section 8.
Yes, I agree, sir. I'm just asking you to connect the dots. Thank you. Do they belong to the drug cartels? Do they belong to the human trafficking ring? Nobody knows. They're simply welcomed in Minnesota. And now I would like to connect the Bill HF4 with the Bill HF100. Bill HF4 will provide those immigrants opportunity to get the driver's license. Yes, sir.
I'm going to have to cut you off. I mean, either you go to Article 1, Section 8, Section 21, 22, 23, 33, or 42.
Yes.
Or we're done.
Thank you. I'm going to go there. Bill HF 100 will provide the job opportunities for the drug cartel members to open cannabis dispensary. Do the bill author require the background check for opening cannabis dispensaries? What can go wrong? According to the National Institute of Drug Abuse, an estimated 85% of the prison inmates either have a substance abuse problem or were on drugs at the time of their offense. I believe that legalization of marijuana will drive all kinds of crime up. Even the authors of Bill HF 100 acknowledge this by appropriating $20 million to law enforcement. Yes, sir.
I guess we're done. You are unable to confine your comments to Article 1. We are not the Public Safety Committee. I would encourage you to go to that if it hasn't already been there. I've given you three opportunities here. Please confine your records or we'll move to the next testifiers.
Okay, thank you. I believe that the crime and increasing crime, it's my environment, and I'm concerned about that. Thank you.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify? Any members of the public? Yes. If you could come forward and identify yourself for the record.
I guess I would like to
If you could. Yeah, if you could just state that, and then I think Representative Stevenson will work with you on the next committee. Just state that and your name so you can connect.
My name is Keith Grunup. Some people call me Sam, but anyway, I would like to testify on behalf of the youth of this nation, and it's related to this bill specifically, so could I do that at a time that's specific to a broader view of the bill?
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll work with you, sir, afterwards to identify a good committee that you could have a chance to testify on. Thank you. After we're done here, I'll talk to you.
Great. Can I leave?
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Anyone else in the audience to the provisions of the environment? Members of the committee, any questions? Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair. To Representative Stevenson or a testifier, whatever works. I just was wanting to confirm if the environmental standards in these facilities that they need to comply with, is that new or is that more or less just a repackaging of existing requirements?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heintzman, I think that, you know, the language, because this is a new industry, we are talking about new rules, new requirements that are not currently in law, if I'm following your question correctly.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair.
I mean,
Representative Stevens.
They would be subject to all existing law, too, if that's what you're driving at. I think maybe I'm not following your question correctly.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair. I'll try to restate it. Is there anything different or unique about what you're having to do here compared to existing statute that would otherwise be enforced by MPCA or other agencies?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heintzman, you know, I think cannabis is a unique industry and it might present some unique challenges. There's nothing particularly novel in its approach to the environment here that I have noticed, but I suppose that's in the eye of the beholder in a certain extent.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It wasn't a big deal, Representative. I was just curious if there was something different here, something chemically different, that's all.
Yeah.
I did have some other questions, Mr. Chair. Okay.
I see Representative Gilman has a question. Do you want to?
He can go.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Heisman.
I'll try to wrap up quickly, but I do have a few more, hoping that maybe MPCA could come down and give us a ballpark idea what their thoughts are relative to rulemaking and such.
We have Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, Mr. Johnson. You want to identify yourself for the record, and back to Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Tom Johnson, Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair. Couple things. Just first of all, could we just get confirmation from you that the dollars that are appropriated to the agency are going to cover the costs associated with the in additional responsibilities that the agency will have?
That's correct, Representative and Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, thank you. And I think that we provided some updated numbers to MMB. We might also provide those to the author, but they would be very small changes just related to the change in FTE that's happened for increased costs that the agency has identified.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to confirm that. I appreciate that. I also was hoping that maybe Colonel Rodman Smith could also testify to that question specific to his jurisdictional area.
Colonel Smith, Department of Natural Resources. Welcome to the committee and state your name for the record.
Colonel Rodman Smith, Director of Enforcement, Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Chair, Representative Heintzman, we were talking snowmobiles back there. If you could repeat the question, please.
Representative Heintzman.
That's okay. It was just in the just trying to use time as best I could. I was just wanting to confirm with MPCA minutes ago that the appropriation that would cover the costs of their effort was satisfactory, and just wanted to do that. There's an appropriation, I think it's 299,000, I believe, for in training and such for conservation officers, just confirming that that is adequate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Heitzman, yes. And so we do need to train all our officers on basically what's called drug recognition expert, DRE. It's training that we haven't done before. It's going to have to put everybody through. It's a one-time cost, and we've worked through that process, and that's what it'll cost to get our people up to speed so that they can detect impaired operators on either snowmobiles, ATVs, watercraft, or whatnot. So it's a little bit different than alcohol. It takes a little bit more training to be able to recognize that in the field, and so that's why that cost is a little higher.
Representative Heitzman.
That's all. Thank you, Chair.
Representative Gilman, and then Representative Vang.
Wonderful. Thank you, Chair. So just to kind of piggyback off of Rep. Heisman's, just looking at the environmental impact of just increased use of electricity and water, I've got just some information in regards to Denver. I just wanted to share a little bit of info and just see if you've thought about some of these things. So indoor cannabis cultivation operations often require high-level electricity service and infrastructure. Indoor grow uses a variety of heavy-load electrical devices such as UV lights, upwards to 16 hours per day, irrigation systems, HVAC systems, and air filtering to manage humidity and plant organic odors. In Denver, for example, the portion of electricity use attributed to the growth of cannabis doubled in the first 3 years after legalization, approaching 5% of total electricity use for the city with 2.8 million residents. In addition to the high electricity demand, the range of estimates for carbon dioxide footprint from cannabis growth operations is especially concerning and significant. So, it's estimated that cannabis indoor growth CO2 emissions could range from 0.5 to 15 million metric tons per year, which is roughly equivalent to an additional 3.3 million cars on the road. The significant electricity demand and potential high CO2 footprint will likely be subject to reduction programs already in place for other industries or cause an indirect cost impact to the already highly regulated electricity providers. So in this committee here, I just wondered, just have we studied what's working and not working in other states, and then what regulations are around that? Because you think about Denver having 2.8 million residents, and who's going to bear the load of this? Who's going to be impacted by this the most in Minnesota? That's my big concern, and I think we need to delve into that and what's working and not working before we just punch this through committee after committee.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. Yeah, I think that there has been a lot of thought and effort. I know that there was a lot of hours put in the development of this particular bill. I know I was part of that. And there has been a lot of thought, and the bill has been through multiple committees over multiple years and a lot of discussion on this particular issue. I don't know, you know, you were reading some information there and you didn't share the source of that particular information. It sounds like maybe you'll be able to do that. I have heard conflicting information about increases in energy from other places. I actually just looked into this because someone asked me about this in an earlier conversation today and found a study showed an increase of 3% of electrical consumption in Seattle. When they did legalization, and I'm, you know, when you're getting down to a 3% increase as opposed to the very significant increase that you were suggesting, you kind of, I'll start to wonder about methodology and otherwise. In terms of who's going to, you know, bear the cost of that, I mean, I'm not sure if this is what you're driving at, but obviously these are consumers of electricity, these businesses, they're going to pay for the electricity, they're going to pay for the water. In terms of what we're trying to do in this bill, we're trying to have the regulator establish some standards to make sure that we're following the best practices, that we're not having adverse impacts on communities and environments in terms of not just water and air, but odor and other things. And that's in the bill. So I think there's been a lot of thought put in this. This has been an issue that's been in the public eye and before this legislature for several years now, and a lot of thought has gone into this as we go through the process.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you for your information. So, yeah, 3% in Seattle. This is stating 5%. And if you go to Clark Hill, you can, clarkhill.com, you can find this information. And just, you know, not only have I had constituents, but also other folks just concerned about our base load. And when we talk about climate impact, and that's what we're here for, to have those discussions, I'm real curious to see as we're heading away from some of these things, for Minnesota, these big conversations to move away from electricity, you know, again, we also have grow points that are in our state for the last, you know, that have been able to manufacture. And so I'd love to have some information from them to see what are their costs, what are they incurring, how much is it increased. And as we talk to our police and just, you know, how they find, you know, illegal operations, they look at where there's increases in electrical, just in electricity spikes. So that's just something that's very much on the forefront of my mind here, and happy that we can have these discussions and come back to just the impact of even a 5% increase, what would that look like when we're talking?
Representative Stevenson.
No, I think it's a thing that has been thought about quite extensively, and I'm, you know, the companies you're talking about that currently operate, growing operations, the medical companies, I can say it with great confidence that if you wanted to go and talk to them and explore that, they'd be very happy to discuss that with you. And in fact, they'd even be happy to give you a tour. I'm very confident of that because they're very, they've been very, open with those invitations to all sorts of people. So I think you'll find that they'll be very open to having that conversation with you if you want to pursue it with them.
Thank you.
Representative Vang.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. If it's all right, is it okay for us to take a little step back to have, since considering this is a rather large bill, if it's all right to have the bill author or nonpartisan staff to just walk through the sections relevant to the Environment Committee, as I think it will be beneficial for not only just members of the committee, but also members of the public to understand what sections we're referring to when we're talking to about regarding House File 100. So that's okay. You indulge me, Mr. Chair?
Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm actually going to turn it over to Ben Johnson. He's been dealing with this particular bill.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. As the chair noted at the beginning, the relevant sections for this committee are all in Article 1. The first is Section 8 that deals with the establishment of environmental standards. It directs the office to consult with the Commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency to establish appropriate standards for water use and disposal for cannabis businesses, as well as for energy uses. The next relevant provisions are related specifically to licensing. The first is in Section 21 of Article 1. That's the cannabis cultivator license. That's the license for the entities that will actually grow the plant material. The relevant provision in there requires the cannabis cultivator to provide a plan, essentially a cultivation plan that describes how it will use water and energy and those related things. The next relevant section is Section 22. That's the cannabis cultivator operations. Similarly, it requires the cannabis cultivator to operate within the standards that are established in that Section 8 that we already discussed. The following section is Section 23. This is cannabis manufacturer licensing. Similarly, this is a licensing requirement that requires the cannabis manufacturer to identify how it will use water, energy, and those sorts of environmental impact in order so that there's a disclosure about those particular items. Section 33 is another form of licensing. That's the cannabis microbusiness licensing. The microbusinesses are essentially smaller operators that can perform a variety of different tasks. They can grow, manufacture, and sell at the retail level. However, all of the requirements for the cultivation and the manufacturing license apply to the microbusiness license. So the provisions I just discussed would apply to this category of license as well. The final section that the chair identified is section 44. That is another licensing provision. This is the medical cannabis processor license. This is similar to a manufacturer license. And again, this is a requirement that they share their plans related to water use and energy use. Mr. Chair, I think those are the provisions that you identified as relevant to the committee.
Representative Vang.
That is all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. So, Representative Stevenson, maybe a question just on safety. On states where marijuana has been legalized, has there been an increase in impaired drivers?
Representative Stevenson, did you cover that in public safety? Or?
Mr. Chair, it will be covered in public safety. We have not appeared in public safety yet, but I'll answer the question if you want me to. Or that ends up being a tricky question to answer because it depends on how you measure it. The issue with cannabis, or one issue with cannabis, is that unlike alcohol, which leaves the body very quickly, relatively speaking, after consumption, cannabis resides, you know, can be detected in your body long after you are no longer intoxicated. And so different studies have found different things depending upon their methodology. You know, for example, there was a study out of Colorado that has gained a lot of traction showing that the instance in which people have had cannabis detected in their you know, blood after a crash increased relatively dramatically after legalization. But that isn't an indication that there were a lot more intoxicated drivers necessarily, because as I mentioned a minute ago, you could have consumed cannabis long before your accident, not been impaired by cannabis, and still gotten into an accident, and then you would test to have that substance in your bloodstream. Other studies have shown negligible increases in traffic accidents attributable to cannabis. So it's a matter of some dispute, but I tend to think when I look at the methodology that I find more support for the idea that there has not been a dramatic increase in impaired driving arrests, or impaired driving, excuse me, following legalization.
Thank you.
Representative Purcell and then Representative Burkle, and just to kind of foreshadow, we have a hard stop at 4:30. So, Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am sorely disappointed that one of our testifiers could not be here, Tom Cotter. I have been to his farm. I have visited his operation and heard him speak at length and very eloquently about how important this is for him as an agricultural producer and as a small farmer, and he grows outdoors and is really a model and a wonderful resource. I believe he grows for CBD, so it's a little different thing. It's a different strain and type of plant, but I have learned a lot from him, so it's unfortunate he couldn't be here, but I'm sure he would be a great resource for us to ask the environmental questions that we have. That's all I have.
Representative Stevenson.
I think that, I don't know if I have anything to add to that. It sounds like a wonderful individual. I wish he could be here, and maybe he'll be available when we come to the Ag Committee.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Stevenson, I'm curious, the original bill that we've read the last couple of years had a provision that included something to the effect, and I'll try and keep this pertinent to the environment conversation we're having, but something to the effect that electric vehicles were the only way to transport cannabis products, and I'm curious why that would be taken out if the purpose is environmental stewardship.
Representative Stevenson.
You know, as we reviewed the bill and tried to streamline it, that was a provision that we thought that we could accomplish some of the environmental goals without being quite so prescriptive.
Representative Burkle.
Nothing further.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment to Chair Stevenson. I really appreciate the path forward for you and having the agencies consult with each other on these standards. I would encourage, you know, if possible, for us to clearly define for the agencies to do outreach to, you know, some of the targeted folks that you are, you know, focusing on for social equity, so that maybe, you know, a small business of color or a business from disadvantaged communities actually, you know, could have input into this as we move forward. And so I really appreciate you having that focus on equity. And so I would encourage you as you move forward to use that equity lens and put it into the standards too. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Stevenson.
I think that's a great idea, Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, Chair Lee, and we'll have to keep refining that and working on that because I think you bring a great point.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Stevenson. In other states, as you've studied this and put a lot of great work into this, have you seen in places where they are growing, where they're growing hemp or cannabis, what impacts have you seen to the ecosystems and positively or negatively towards other areas of agriculture?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, I don't know that I have a great answer to that that question about how the hemp has affected some other ecosystems. You know, I think that what we're trying to do in this bill is ensure that we have responsible environmental controls in place so that we can protect the wonderful environment that we have in Minnesota while still growing this new industry here.
Representative Schultz.
Yeah, so thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. So there hasn't been any, you haven't seen any negative impacts to nature and ecosystems in the research that you've done?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, I haven't seen any, you know, anything that's really caught my eye in that respect, no.
Thank you.
Representative Jordan has a question for one of the testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just a pretty basic question for Ms. Fatihi, if she could come forward.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is a basic question about how cannabis is produced and grown. I know there are, and we have different processes laid out in this bill about the difference of growing cannabis indoors versus out of doors. What effect does growing this plant indoors versus out of doors have on the product? And why are there such different regulations surrounding the two different methods of growing this plant?
Ms. Fahdi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, Representative Jordan. There are different processes, and I'd be happy to get some additional clarification from all of you from some of our agricultural experts. But in terms of the usage of resources and the planning around them, I mean, they're fundamentally different. You're, you know, when you're growing the plant outdoor, it's in situ. You know, the water management practices are different. The application of agricultural chemicals presumably would be different. And if you are doing it in an indoor environment, then your energy usages may be different and your ability to, you know, whether it's an open system or a closed system, I imagine, you know, those would make fundamentally different, big differences in terms of, as a business, how you are planning and what kind of environmental externalities there are and where you can remediate and all sorts of things.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And does growing a plant indoor or outdoors have an effect on the product and the uses for the raw flower that is, or other cannabis-derived products differ based on the method in which the plant is grown?
Ms. Fati.
Yeah, I mean, this is the cultivation of cannabis. As someone who is not a cannabis cultivator but has been spending a lot of time with them over the last 5 years, the level of, you know, sophistication of understanding, you know, the plant and where you grow it, how you grow it, the type of soil, the type of genetics, all of these things make fundamental differences in terms of the properties of the end product. And so, I mean, this is not... you know, like the growing the ditchweed in the, you know, backyard kind of thing. This is a sophisticated industry that is producing products. Increasingly, you know, one of the things that we hear from the cultivators is that they're not, when they're growing these plants and making their decisions about these kinds of things, it's not with an eye for, you know, even getting people intoxicated. Increasingly, it has to do with, you know, what are the the type of cannabinoids and the different levels in them and things like that, so that consumers have a broader range of options based on those effects, beyond just, you know, intoxication.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Fatihi, for that answer. I'm just trying to get a better understanding of this industry, and I really want to thank Representative Stevenson for his work on this bill. This is something that's very important to my constituents and myself, and I'm happy to support the bill and work with you to ensure that it's the best bill in the country going forward. Thank you.
Representative Scraba.
Thank you, Chairman. Representative Stevenson, I'm curious the size of the outdoor fields. Are we looking at 40 acres, 160 acres? Is there a limit? Or I think Representative Schultz is, I started thinking, I'm a pheasant hunter and I walk through corn, you know, in the future, am I going to be walking through fields of this, or what am I looking at, or what are we seeing? Thank you.
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scraba, you know, the focus of the bill has really been to encourage small operators as opposed to large, significant operators. There are limits in the bill. I maybe would direct the question to Mr. Johnson if you could speak to the limits specifically with regard to the cultivators.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, there are three categories of cultivation license. The smallest is the micro business that I mentioned earlier. It's measured by plant canopy, and it's 5,000 square feet of plant canopy. The office does have the flexibility to extend that and make it up to 10,000 square feet, but it starts out at the 5,000 square feet limit. The next is the craft cultivator level, and that begins at 10,000 square feet, up to 10,000 square feet. Again, the office has some flexibility there and can extend that up to 15,000 square feet. The largest is what's called a bulk cultivator license, and that can be up to 30,000 feet of plant canopy. There is the ability to have multiple licenses at the discretion of the office. So if the office determined that it was appropriate or necessary, a single entity could have multiple of those licenses and potentially be larger, but that's not how the bill is intended and drafted initially. The office is also given direction to begin by issuing the smaller level licenses and to only issue those bulk licenses if needed to produce the sufficient supply for the state.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Any other questions, members? Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair. And Representative Stevenson, I got to give you a lot of credit. You've done a lot of research on this, and certainly it impacts many different things, and certainly a lot more than I have ever done. I'll just state that up front. So as we're considering land use, water use, impacts to ecosystems, my initial research and the work that I've done is just suggesting that, you know, that there are land use concerns, specifically as it relates to things like pesticides and things used to treat hemp, cannabis, and along those lines. Have you done research into that, and how does this bill directly impact that as it relates to growers here in Minnesota?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair and Representative, you know, as I said, we've taken a pretty comprehensive approach in this bill. We've tried to institute the protections necessary to make sure that the cannabis industry can operate in a responsible way, in a legal way, in a safe way that doesn't unduly burden anybody else. There are provisions governing the specific requirements that cultivators have to follow. And I maybe will ask Mr. Johnson if he wants to add anything to that in terms of the specifics with regard to what Mr. Schultz had asked about.
Mr. Johnson.
Representative Schultz, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, members, I can very briefly say that because it is not recognized as legal at the federal level, there are no federally approved pesticides at this point for growing cannabis. The bill does, however, authorize the office to identify appropriate pesticides and set those limits, again, based on the decisions that the office makes, based on the best practices and the information that the office receives. And then any pesticides that would potentially be approved for use would have to be disclosed to the testing facilities, and it would be tested for any residual pesticide in any, both the flower, the plant material, and any products made from that flower.
And Representative Schultz, I believe the bill is going to the Ag Committee. There are some across jurisdictions with pesticides, but Chair Vang, I see is nodding her head, and there will probably be a fuller discussion there. But
it seems, thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems like a very worthwhile discussion, given especially where it stands on the federal level, right? Meaning Minnesota might have to take more of a leading role. And it sounds like some of those conversations are being had. Like I mentioned, I'm in no way an expert in this space, but it's also important, right? Important for our water, important for the ground. And so I'd like that to be a part of your future discussions on this bill. And further, the other thing that I read is that this type of growing is pretty significant towards water use, water use is a big deal for the farmers in my district, and the DNR certainly has a lot to play there. So, do we have additional concerns around the amount of water that will be used through the growing of these plants?
Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz, there are requirements in the bill, as have been mentioned. I did at the beginning, Mr. Johnson did in the walkthrough, that water regulations would be addressed. And again, I go back to the starting principle that we want to do this in a way that is responsible, safe, protects the environment, doesn't unduly burden neighbors. I'd also note that this is probably an area where there is at least some benefit as to Vice Chair Jordan's comments about indoor growing, where you can use the really specific measurements of water. I'm blanking on the word, but microdose, I guess, maybe.
Sure.
the water into the plant, and actually in some of the operations that I toured, they have very specific ways that are able to really limit the amount of water that is consumed.
Yeah. Chair Hansen and Representative Stevenson, what's been interesting is to see that as it's happened in other states, it appears like they're almost guiding the conversation, especially in more arid climates, towards indoor growing rather than but in Minnesota we don't necessarily find ourselves in that place. So I'll be interested to see how this conversation develops here in the future, and certainly something we need to consider the right policy. Thank you.
Representative Stevenson, I have a question on page 25. In lines 25.9 through 25.19.
I seem to have lost the page that had open. Just one second, Mr. Chair. No, I have it on my, I just closed the tab, I think, accidentally. 25, you said.
So this is relating to odor, and the office by rule must establish appropriate standards and requirements to limit odors produced by the cannabis business. If you could maybe just elaborate on that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As I have said a few different times, I think that, one of the goals of this bill is to have a legal cannabis business, but one that operates responsibly, safely, without undue influence impact on neighbors. And we know that this is a concern that people have had about odor, and so we are giving the Cannabis Management Agency the tools that it needs in order to regulate that and make sure that we have some controls in place on odor.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. I'd like that you got that on the record, because I will use that as a precedent for other odor regulations that we will be bringing forward in this committee this year. Anything else? Representative Stevenson, to close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for this great discussion today. I know many of you have already seen this bill in a different committee, and the rest of you will see it in another committee. I'm very confident. We have 11 more to go. So thanks for the discussion. I ask for a yes vote.
I will renew my motion that House File 100 be recommended to be re-referred to the Labor and Industry Finance and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
Motion prevails. The motion is adopted. We are adjourned.